funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the relationship between black culture and hair? As my guest today will tell us, black Americans have long found their hair to be a signifier of social class, status, and at times even political and religious views. And while many people have mixed feelings about the particular head of hair they were born with, many have also found their locks to be a great source of beauty and pride, even a link to their histories. Lori L. Tharps is assistant professor of journalism at Temple University and co-author, along with Amanda D. Byrd, of the book Hair Story, Untangling the Roots of Black Hair in America. A newly revised and updated edition is available now. Lori, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
What inspired you to write about this subject in the first place?
Well, actually, the book for me started as my master's thesis when I was in graduate school. And I went to Columbia Journalism School, and every student had to select a topic that they were going to report on for an entire year. And all of our advisors, you know, warned us that you better pick a topic that was going to keep you interested for a year. And so, you know, we were given, you know, a nice bit of time to select something, and I just knew I wanted to write about something that, you know, kind of concerned me personally, but also had a wider would have a wider impact on my cultural community, which was the black community. And so I went through a lot of different ideas, and nothing really seemed to stick until I came up with the idea of hair. And it seemed to me that as a black woman living at the time in New York City, you know, one of the most multicultural and diverse locations, that people still didn't seem to understand my hair. I still would have conversations with people from all walks of life who would ask me questions that I thought were so strange, like, you know, what is that shampoo you're using? It's such a strange thing. I've never heard of it before. Or, you know, how do you do your hair? Or, you know, do you wash your hair? And things that were innocent questions yet made me feel somehow guilty or something, and also just that the questions kept happening. So I figured there was really something going on, and that there was this big disconnect between black and non-black Americans when it came to hair, and I wanted to figure what that was. I had no idea going into it that it would be such a complicated and interesting history, but, you know, I kind of just thought it was going to be one of those, I don't know, something that you could probably sell to a magazine later on, but it really ended up being so much more deep and meaningful and political and historical and you know, having really significant economic impacts as well. So it kind of started as this is kind of interesting, and ended up as, you know, being basically the beginning of a book.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One thing that comes up in the book is, I can imagine it would be frustrating if people are constantly asking you ridiculous questions about your hair. But you mentioned that, like, for example, on TV, Americans all saw Marsha Brady brushing her hair 100 strokes, and nobody saw Denise Huxtable getting her hair ready.
Exactly. And that's what was so distressing, and why, you know, it was funny because my advisor in graduate school at first, she happened to be a white woman from England, and her first thought was, this is not a real topic. You might get a personal essay out of this. You're not going to get this is not worthy of academic inquiry. And when I handed it in, she actually invited me to her home to both apologize and suggest I turn this into a book, because she said, people don't know this information. It's really something that people don't get. And that was all along. This wasn't a book like, oh, this just is a good book for black people to read. This is really a book for all Americans to read, because there was, again, we tend to look at, you know, racial discourse or racial complications as on really big level policy issues. But when we say that we don't understand each other's simple kind of everyday habits about how you do your hair or why does your hair look like that, if one group of people understands or is meant to, let's say, you know, the way Marsha Brady does her hair is kind of the American way, but there's a lot of people who don't do those things to their hair, and it wasn't just what you see on TV, it was even the salon, the products. It was a completely segregated way of doing things, so it, of course, it makes sense that white and black are disconnected when it came to hair practices, but white hair practices are always in view, whether it's on a billboard, in a magazine, on a TV show, and black hair practices have almost always been kind of hidden in secret. So it's not, nobody can fault non-black people for not understanding black hair culture, but we understand that some of the problems and conflicts that happen come about simply because of a lack of information. And again, that's why we wanted to write the book, to kind of break it all open and share with everybody, both black, white, and everybody in between, what is at the, sorry for the cliche and the pun, but what is at the root of the kind of conflict and issues. And again, a lot of it is just lack of information, but also it is, you know, something, hair for black Americans is not just a beauty thing. Mm-hmm. It has so much more meaning to it that, again, if you don't know that, when you ask what might seem to be an innocent question, or you make a policy like, you know, you cannot wear this style of hair or something, you're not just talking about a choice of about something that has historical, cultural, even religious sometimes significance to people.
Well, I love where you start the book, because you begin with black hair in Africa, where historically many societies had deep traditions tied to the way they cared for their hair, they styled their hair.
Right.
You could almost tell where someone was from based on the way they would arrange their hair.
Right, and that was where, you know, we had our first aha moments of, wow, this is so meaningful. And we knew we wanted to start kind of at the beginning, because we wanted to find out what Africans, the relationship Africans had with their hair before they were brought to this country as to be slaves. And what we found was that these hairstyles were actually, we say, more significant than somebody's name. Your hairstyle told basically your whole kind of life story, your whole identity, what family you belong to, what level of society you were. The higher level in society you had, the more elaborate your hairstyle was. So that meant many men had more elaborate hairstyles than their wives, because they often were, you know, the chiefs of, you know, the tribes or the families. Your family, if a woman was in mourning, she had a specific hairstyle, or maybe didn't do her hair. That might be the only time a woman was, it was okay to see a woman without a styled, a particular hairstyle. Mm. So also, because these styles were so intricate, you only had like a one designated hairstylist for the community, for the family, for the tribe, and that person was, you know, considered an artisan. And so you didn't just let anybody touch your hair. This person was very highly valued. Oftentimes, if you wanted to extend an offer of friendship or something, you might offer to do someone's hair, and hairstyling time became a great part of community building even. So there was this real level of love, reverence, community building, and importance given to the hair. And also, I forgot to mention, is that a lot of the different cultures believe that the hair, since it was the closest thing to the gods, was how the gods sent messages to people. Mm. So it even had a spiritual dimension to it. So all of these aspects of what the hair meant were, you know, the hair was shaved off of the slaves when they were brought, of the Africans when they were brought as slaves, but it didn't make those, that meaning disappear. So sometimes today we even, you know, we might feel there might be like kind of old world superstitions, like don't let anybody touch your hair, only let certain people touch your hair, or when you cut your hair, make sure you gather up all the loose pieces because something bad will happen if somebody gets your hair. All of that kind of harkens back to some of the meaning that hair had in Africa, and even the ideas of using the hair to express one's identity and to adorn oneself. Those ideas also, we can make connections to them from then to now, as opposed to feeling, you know, like the things I'm doing with my hair, the things I feel about my hair are meaningless or just silly. So that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to start from the beginning, where the relationship that black Africans had with the hair was one of great respect and love and care, and then see what went wrong or what happened in between then and now. And that's basically the story we're trying to tell in Hair Story.
It also does add weight to something that I think a lot of people are aware of, that many newly kidnapped people, when they were brought to this country to be slaves, had their heads shaved. We know that that's a humiliating thing for anyone, but it really,
right.
We understand how much worse it must have been for people from cultures that really focused a lot of attention on hair.
Exactly. And again, we know from, I mean, if many people understand what the slave trade, what the transit, that actual journey from, you know, across the ocean, how humiliating, demeaning, painful, sickening it was. And we know that different tribes were, you know, mixed together so people couldn't plan rebellions. But that was also another reason that the hair was shaved, because, you know, like I said, if the people could identify one another from their hairstyles. So that was just one other way to, you know, make these humans anonymous, you know, to make them seem, you know, less like a unique individual and more just like, you know, an anonymous thing, if you will. And it, you know, it eliminated another way for people to band together to see, you know, to connect with one another.
So what do we know, Lori, about how people held in slavery dealt with their hair when they had so little time and none of the traditional products that their ancestors had used to take care of their hair?
Well, that's also, again, it was once we, you know, this for my co-author, Ayanna Bird, and I, this was, again, what we were discovering this ourselves, and it was also fascinating. We learned how ingenious these slaves were, you know, again, basically, I mean, overall, not a lot of slaves were trying to make their hair look nice. They were trying to stay alive. So for a lot of men and women, you know, this love affair they had with their hair, this appreciation for this wonderful kind of almost artifact growing out of their heads became something that you just put a rag over and forgot about. Black hair definitely has, I mean, it's not something you can forget about and then, you know, later just brush it out. So a lot of women, you know, their hair didn't grow. They got scalp diseases because, you know, they were, you know, working, sweating, and keeping their heads covered to protect them from the sun, protect them from, you know, the elements. A lot of men would just shave their heads to be done with the issue of dealing with their hair. But we do know that there quickly grew opportunities to, you know, there were Sundays where the slaves were given off to, you know, care for themselves, and they created all kinds of products from, you know, there was a lot of the hair products in Africa were based on plant products that grew there naturally, so they, you know, kind of had to, they had to be creative with finding something similar, you know, instead of, you know, an oil that was found on a specific tree in Africa, they used an oil found, you know, in the United States. They often use like pig lard, for example, for a moisturizer for the hair, or they would try to straighten the hair using heat, and they would use heat in different ways. For example, they would take pieces of flannel, just pieces of cotton, and heat them in the fire. I mean, not till they got on fire, but just heat them enough, and then run them through the hair to kind of straighten it, which, you know, is kind of a precursor to the flat iron, or they would take yarn and wrap a baby's hair in yarn, you know, wrap it around the tendrils, hoping to pull it straight so that it would be straighter. And that's one of the things that happened with hair in slave during slavery, is that the hair became one of the markers of African identity, if you will. And the more African you looked, the less the less African you looked, the more likely you were to be treated better in the slave system. So the lighter-skinned slaves with the looser curled hair tended to have, because they usually were the offspring of the master or had some white blood in them, tended to be the ones that had, you know, were worked in the house, had less back-breaking labor, and possibly would get access to better food, clothing, and maybe even freedom.
Let me jump in. We have to take a break here. My guest is Lori L. Farps. Her book, Hair Story, Untangling the Roots of Black Hair in America, has just been updated. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you: the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Lori L. Tharps, Assistant Professor of Journalism at Temple University. She is co-author, along with Ayanna D. Byrd, of the book Hair Story, Untangling the Roots of Black Hair in America. A newly revised edition is available now. If you'd like to join the conversation, please do. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Okay, so Lori, there was this undeniable effect that people who were kept in slavery, who had features that looked less African and perhaps more European, however that was defined, would do better. And so that helped to drive, both during the times of slavery and after, a little booming business in hair care that would allow people to have straighter hair than they might naturally have had.
Absolutely. Basically, the life after slavery and up until today, really, there's been this quest for black women specifically, and men too, to a certain extent, to have straighter hair. And that has been, like I said, initially that was about survival and, getting a better treatment as a slave, but also because there were plenty of free blacks in America even before slavery was officially abolished, and many of those free blacks were the products of a black and white union. So we're talking about people who were actually biracial. And so, again, the attempt was to emulate as much as possible European features so that one could be taken for free and or taken for less African and all that entailed. And even like you said, that's where our post-slavery in the early 20th century, we had a booming business of hair straightening. But it wasn't the largest, the most popular figure of that time, of course, is Madam C.J. Walker and Annie Turnbull Malone, who's less known but was equally important at the time. These were both self-made millionaire women who made their money off of selling hair products. But both of them were very, very clear that they were not trying to help black women look white. They were trying to help black women look beautiful, because black women deserve to spend time on their hair, and they deserve to have pampering and beauty rituals as their European or white American counterparts had. And they were not looking at their regimens for hair straightening, which was mostly using a straightening comb at that time, with, again, trying to look white. They were saying, you feel better about yourself when you look good and you have a healthy head of hair. And one of Madam C.J. Walker's best-selling products was her wonderful hair grower, because remember, as we said before, during slavery, a lot of women were just covering their hair and making do. Well, now they had a little bit of time to themselves to, to primp a little bit. And now that they could, they wanted to. And who wouldn't feel better with a beautiful head of hair as opposed to wearing a headscarf on your head? So, yes, the turn of the century saw a lot of women and men making money selling hair care products specifically for black women. And they weren't only black people doing that. There were non-black people also saying, black people, it's time for you to be able to spend money and time on your hair. And we saw the beginning of what is today the, $9 billion ethnic hair care industry. The thing is that in the early 20th century, when we did have people like Madam C.J. Walker, Annie Turnbull Malone, Sarah Spencer Washington, who were making millions of dollars, what they did with that money was funnel it back into the black community and found black colleges and schools and community centers, which is, again, today why so many black people get so emotional when black-owned hair care businesses are sold to multinational companies, because it feels like this has been our industry, which has fueled our community, and now it's being taken away. And yes, it's business, but it's also been our business that has helped our community grow. So again, this is why the book was so important, because we wanted to examine you know, were black people being just a little bit oversensitive when they would have a funeral when Revlon was, you know, purchasing a black hair care company? Or was there something more to it? And we found out that there really was something more to it in that, you know, the first all-black university, Wilberforce University, was actually founded by black barbers. So there is more to every story as it relates to black hair, even when it comes to the economics, than, you know, just green. It's not just about the money. It's about the fact that this was money made by black people for black people and then utilized in the black community.
Well, and that brings the sort of backstory of the Jerry Curl into focus. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, and that's always a great story. See, the thing about black hair is there's so many stories to tell, and they're all so fascinating, and everybody can relate to something. The Jerry Curl was like the antithesis of the Afro. It was the industry's, it was like the hair care industry's response to the Afro. And so you can't really talk about how amazing the Jerry Curl was without understanding that when the back to natural movement of the 50s and 60s, the original, you know, natural hair movement, when black people en masse stopped using chemicals on their hair and started wearing Afros, the hair care industry really took a nosedive because black people were saying, I don't need any products. I just need my Afro pick, and I'm good to go. Mm-hmm. So when in the early 70s, when the Jerry Curl was invented, here was a product that required constant maintenance and lots of products.
Mm-hmm.
And so the salons were, you know, stylists who would never, of course, the Jerry Curl was a new product, but stylists learned how to use it right away, you know, immediately started offering the services, and, you know, men, women, and children, because there were kiddie kits for, there was kiddie Jerry Curls. So everybody was doing them, and the industry kind of rebounded gloriously through the 70s and 80s, the late 70s and early 80s with the Jerry Curl, and even into the 90s. People are still wearing Jerry Curls, we have to be honest. But that was kind of the highlight of the hair care industry post early 20th century because it required so many products and so much maintenance. And what's interesting today with this with the kind of new natural hair movement, it's almost as if industry insiders said we're not going to be caught unaware again. And whereas in the 70s or the 60s, when people started going natural, they got rid of all their products. This time around, you have a new natural hair movement, and there are more products than you even needed to maintain your Jerry Curl in order to keep, quote-unquote, natural this time around. So that Jerry Curl, people still, you know, it's funny if you talk to kind of older stylists, they kind of, their eyes kind of get all shiny, and they remember the good old days of the Jerry Curl, which is really kind of funny. Because the rest of us think, oh, the messy, drippy days of the Jerry Curl.
Yeah. Well, talk about this. The definition of natural is not so easy to pin down, even for people within the black community.
Yes, and that's one of the main things we talk about in the updated version is, you know, we basically, in the original version of the book, we kind of stopped writing around 2000. And so the updated version we pick up from 2000 to 2013, and one of the biggest things to happen in that time period was this new, this natural hair movement. And while we have obviously, I mean, our book does not kind of take sides or applaud anybody over another, but we are very excited to watch this unfold where black women all over the United States have been able to find resources and support and community to stop wearing relaxers, to stop wearing fake hair, to embrace their natural hair, and find beauty in it and pleasure and fun, as opposed to thinking black hair was, when I started this conversation, you know, stop thinking that black hair was a chore or something that needed to be altered in order to be attractive or even acceptable in American society. So the natural hair movement has, you know, really been a positive force in a lot of ways. However, like I just said, if the natural hair movement requires 18 products to get your natural hair to look the way you want to, you know, where do we draw the line between natural and kind of natural? Not to mention, you could have quote-unquote natural hair but still be wearing a weave underneath or over. You wear the weave and the natural hair underneath. So And there are many purists in the natural hair movement who would like to say, well, then you're not, or they would like to define it and kind of claim it and decide who is natural and who's not. But our hope as, you know, the writers of this book and kind of observers and not really members of any camp is just that people will, you know, embrace the community aspect of it and the support and stop the policing, because that's kind of how we got here in the first place.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Sterling in Dallas. Hi, Sterling.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
That's good. I just want to comment on the topic of natural hair. I think it is very important for us to talk about this, especially in the Black community, because we are entering into an age of more natural hairstyles. And even as an African-American man, I've started to develop my own natural hair. And I think we should just become comfortable with who we are and just really celebrate our individuality and our uniqueness in the community.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about that, Lori?
I am, I'm so happy to hear, I think Sterling was his name, I'm so happy to hear that Sterling has that idea and those thoughts. One of the things we also want to always point out is that this book is not about women, it's about Black hair, which grows out of Black men and women's heads, and that a lot of these issues people think, you know, are something only women think about or talk about or are affected by, when Black men as well. It's funny because the last few radio shows that we've done, and as we've been on tour with the book, it's been mostly men who have been calling in, and I think it's wonderful that we hear from men who are both embracing their own natural hair as well as supportive of women who are, quote-unquote, going natural, and whatever natural means for them. I think overall our goal with this book has always been so that Black people in general will understand the tremendous journey their hair has been on and how powerful and amazing the hair is in terms of our cultural identity and our cultural history, and that for non-Black people will understand the same thing and just be just more knowledgeable about this interesting aspect of American popular culture, and that there won't be a need to feel ashamed or hide or secret, or that it has to be adjusted to become acceptable in American society.
Can you talk about this idea, Lori, of good hair versus bad hair, that it sounds like it's something you have to sort of deal with as you're growing up and decide how you're going to feel about even the existence of those definitions?
Right, and really the definitions or the terms good and bad hair really were born in slavery, and good and bad hair, I mean, really referred back to those times when, you know, if you had good hair, you had hair that looked more European. It usually meant you had some, you know, you were probably part white in some way, you know, master's child, or maybe not, maybe you were just a product of an interracial coupling, whatever it might have been, mm-hmm. but that was good hair because it indicated status, whether it was within the slave system or you were a free Black. People would look at people who had this kind of hair and assumed that they were more educated, more refined, possibly free, and so that was good. That was definitely good. I mean, there was no way around that. So that was kind of the gold standard of the type of hair you wanted to have, because if you could get that kind of status just by changing your hair, I mean, obviously you would do that. And if you had hair that just wouldn't look like that because it just wasn't going to look like that, then you had bad hair, and that implied also that you were probably a field slave and that you weren't as educated and you didn't have access to freedom and education and things of that nature. So it really wasn't a beauty thing but it stuck within, it became part of the lexicon of the Black hair vernacular. And so we still use those terms today within our community, and unfortunately, they're still used to wound. We often hear our grandmothers, our mothers, depending how old we are, you know, talk about, oh, she has good hair or she has bad hair. And it's interesting because in the Latino community, the same thing. You'll hear pelo bueno and pelo malo. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing, same concepts. And unfortunately, you know, we wrote this book originally, and, I mean, we started doing the research in 1999, and we interviewed, you know, 5- and 6-year-old children, and they knew what good and bad hair was. Hmm. And 2013, when we were researching again, children still know what good and bad hair is. So we still have some ways to go before we can eradicate, you know, before we can talk about those words that used to be used as opposed to the ones that we're still using and that are still painful when, you know, the people who are supposed to be closest to us are using them to classify our hair as either good or bad.
So talk about this. The reality is that for a long time in the United States, there have been black people who have styled their hair in ways that would seem to be reflective of European American standards of what's beautiful. Of course, as everybody knows, many European Americans also, their hair doesn't naturally do what they think it should look like and what is currently in style. And so what do you do with that question? I guess it's hard to ever definitively answer whether, a black person choosing to straighten their hair is doing it because beauty standards have been dictated by European Americans, or if there's some other motivation.
Well, it's such a good question, and it's one that I really, I get, I don't want to say I get tired of, because this is kind of what I write about all the time. So, I mean, we hear it all the time, is she trying to look white? Are they trying to emulate whiteness? And again, this is a question that men get also, and we just don't hear about it as much because we're not shining a light there. But we interviewed men who talk about, they wanted their hair straight. They wanted to be able to whip their hair around. They wanted to run their fingers through their hair like, certain white superstars, whatever the, however old they were, whoever that person was. So you'll see plenty of black men with straight hair, and they'll, they cop to the same kind of influences of a European beauty standard. Now, that being said, a lot of people will point out that even if a black person straightens their hair, it does not look like white hair. Mm-hmm. Like, even the straightest black hair does not look like white hair. And likewise, when you see white people wearing dreadlocks and cornrows, are they trying to look black or they're just trying, a different hairstyle? And likewise, a white person with dreadlocks or cornrows does just not look the same as a black person does. So I think when we live in this community, this society that is so multicultural and so diverse, and we are, to a certain extent, we are past where it has to be, I'm trying to look white, and it really is about convenience, or it's about, what looks good on my face. My face doesn't look good with curly hair. And then you look at, again, so many different cultures who are coexisting, and we do borrow and get inspired by, and there are new products and new things you can do with your hair. What really it comes down to is a person wearing their hair a certain way because they feel intimidated or inferior, or that they might lose their job if they don't wear their hair to look like kind of the status quo?
Yeah.
Or are they making a choice because they just feel like straight hair today, curly hair tomorrow? And that's where we would like to be. And I think
let me jump in. We have to take another quick break. My guest is Lori L. Farps. Her book is called Hair Story, Untangling the Roots of Black Hair in America. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Lori L. Farps, Assistant Professor of Journalism at Temple University and co-author, along with Ayanna D. Byrd, of the book Hair Story, Untangling the Roots of Black Hair in America. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Lori, before the break, you were alluding to the fact that there are black people in America who have lost jobs, typically to white employers, because those employers felt that something as, in my opinion, simple as braids was an extreme hairstyle for the workplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's I want to correct you that it's not always white employers. Well, I shouldn't say that. I mean, we have seen recently young children have been sent home from school where the school was run by a black, principal or leader, and they too have been sent, they've been sent home saying that their dreadlocks were unacceptable or their Afro puffs, they've been banned or outlawed. And we do see in professional circumstances, we have seen different organizations, different corporations, I should say, have, yes, absolutely banned certain styles which they consider extreme, and those styles often include dreadlocks and other natural hairstyles. And when we wrote the book, the first time we wrote the book, the first edition, we talked to a few people who were kind of professional etiquette specialists, and we were in agreement with them when they said that, you know, there are certain professions that are going to require almost a uniform of sorts, you know, suit and tie, you know, nothing flashy. And if wearing your hair in a style that kind of doesn't fit in the corporate environment is important to you, then perhaps you should look for a different office environment. My co-author and I have both been in the journalism professor, and we're now both in academia in some ways. And, you know, we've never had an opportunity where somebody has said your hair is going to hold you back because we've been in creative fields. And likewise, I think, there are some very clear-cut cases where quote-unquote extreme style isn't appropriate. But when we talk about styles like cornrows, braids, or even dreadlocks that are neat, you know, which many dreadlock styles are very neat. You know, you can wear your hair in dreadlocks in a bun. You can wear them pulled back. You know, they're not, you know, Bob Marley style. Bob
right.
Marley's dreadlocks had a, you know, they were great rock star hair dreadlocks. So it's just not acceptable to put a style in your policy code and say that this is unacceptable because it's extreme or it's unnatural or that it goes against, it's not professional. That's really, you know, stepping on the toes of or showing a lack of cultural understanding because, again, this is how black hair grows out of most people's head. And if it can be pulled back and is not distracting, which, again, there are corporate kind of corporate uniforms, if you will, and we understand that you're supposed to be looking as, you know, not call attention to your personal self. We understand that. But there are there should be a better level of understanding that a dreadlock in and of itself isn't offensive. An afro can be short. It can be, you know, tame, if you will. It can be adorned. It doesn't have to be something that, quote unquote, you know, hits the top of the door before you do, kind of thing. And that's what we're seeing, and that's what's kind of that's what's troubling is that a whole swath of black hairstyles are considered, you know, countercultural or inappropriate or not belonging in professional workplaces. And what's even worse is when we see that kind of banning happening. You know, there was a theme park, an amusement park that banned dreadlocks, where you're like, that's just not even, I can't even understand why you have a quote-unquote appropriate hairstyle issue. It's roller coaster we're talking about here. So, again, this is why we wrote the book, is because there's so much misunderstanding about what black hair means. People are still looking at certain hairstyles and connecting them with inferiority, revolutionary, drug dealer, or all kinds of stereotypes that need to be kind of unpacked and understood.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Benjamin on the line in Denton. Hey, Benjamin.
Hey, how you doing, Chris?
Very well, thank you.
I love your show.
Thank you.
I almost never, ever get a chance to comment. But this one, hey, I'm sitting here in my car at lunch. I'll say, I've got to say something.
All right.
And I'm going to tell you what. that young lady that you have there today, I want to ask her a question real quick. Do you remember Sulfur 8?
I've seen it on the shelves.
Yeah, see, I'm old enough to know what Sulfur 8 is. My grandmother used to wrap my head in Sulfur 8 in a head rag and make me sleep in it.
It sounds uncomfortable. Tell us what it is,
it
or what it was.
Well, basically, some people call it a conch, C-O-N-C. It's just a slang term from back in like the 40s and the 50s. This is what black men did to their hair. They would put some grease or some pomade in the hair. They'd sleep with a head rag on. And nowadays, people call them do-rags, because that's exactly what they're for.
Mm-hmm.
And they wake up in the morning and end up looking like Nat King Cole.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Or James Brown. Think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Or Cab Calloway. Think about it.
Yes.
Now, that was acceptable, I guess, because they were in the entertainment industry and, you know, they had to present a certain image other than just, you know, some black guy that did music. But that also extended into the community. My grandmother did this to me all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd wake up in the morning, we'd go somewhere, say on a Sunday, we'd go walk in the church, and I'd have these Spanish ladies coming up to me in Spanish. And I didn't know what they were saying because I looked Spanish because of my hair. And the thing is, there was another term called plantation syndrome, which a lot of black people actually do suffer to. I mean, it's a real thing. I mean, you can get this from blacks or whites. In the military, I always had straight hair anyway. And I'd had people come up to me and say, hey, what you put in your hair, man? Why your hair so straight? Hmm. Dude, I was born like this. What are you talking about?
Well, talk a little bit about that, Lori, and whether, I mean, judgment comes from outside the black community, but it sounds like there are also assumptions within the black community about what's appropriate.
Absolutely. And we always mention that we wrote this book for all Americans, black people, white people, everybody in between, because the misunderstandings, some of the worst hurts and insults come from within the black community. And some of that is, again, because this world of black hair has been, from day one that we were brought here, we have been brainwashed into believing that our hair was inferior. Our hair was literally cataloged as animal-like, not human. So if you are told that over and over again, and slave owners did that on purpose to keep us feeling inferior, because if you felt inferior, you were less likely to rebel, you were less likely to be dependent. So if you were brainwashed this way as a community, I mean, the unbrainwashing never officially happened. So this idea that we have to, they're in a lot of the terminology that we even talk about our hair, whether it's good and bad hair, or even we'll say we have to fix our hair when we mean like to comb your hair. It's like, go comb your hair. A lot of times a black mother will say, go fix your hair, as if to imply there's something wrong with it. So there's a lot within our own community that comes from being in a culture that has been told that there was something inherently wrong with our hair and we needed to fix it before we could step out the door. All of this comes, you know, like our caller just said, you know, his grandmother would wrap his hair up at night. And a lot of times what our parents and our elders passed on to us came from a place not of saying our hair is inferior, but really believing that they were helping us get ahead by making our hair look more European or making it look, quote-unquote, more presentable. You know, a lot of these young women today who are going natural, they have to fight their mothers and their grandmothers, not their employers, to go natural because it's their mothers and grandmothers will look at them and say, you know, we had to fight so hard to not look like what you're doing. What are you doing? Why are you going out there with your hair not straight? People are going to know our secrets. And that is, again, our own work that has to be done. And a lot of that is changing now. I mean, what's really beautiful is to see a young woman saying she went natural and she convinced her mom to go natural too. And that's what's lovely, is to see this generationally changing as well. So the fight, if you will, is not just so that non-black Americans accept our hair, but it's also within the black community also that we stop policing each other and stop, you know, believing what was systematically told to us of our hair being inferior one way or the other. And also we're also seeing also black women and men saying if your hair is straight, you somehow aren't black enough, which is also another just untruth, that your hair, if it's straight, means that you don't support your community or you are less socially conscious as the next person. We have to stop all around deciding that the way that a person wears their hair tells me where their politics are or who they support politically or anything like that. We do want people to feel that their hair can be an expression of identity, but it has to be from themselves and not because of what other people are putting on them.
Lori, I know that the research in this book is really based pretty much exclusively on the American, black Americans and the history of hair here, but I wonder if you've had a chance to look at countries where the overwhelming majority of the population is black and even places where there's not been like a colonial legacy. Like, is there a totally different approach to hair in those places?
Well, you know, originally we wanted to do this book the whole world, but we had to pare it down just because it was such a wide topic.
Yeah.
But yeah, in this new version, we do kind of delve into the fact that this natural hair movement, for example, is spreading around the world, and it's so exciting to see. We've seen, you know, there's an official International Natural Hair Meetup Day, and countries like Japan, the Netherlands, Spain, France, England, the Netherlands have all had, you know, this kind of growing movement now. In fact, in next month, there's going to be a big natural hair gathering in Paris. So we are seeing this awareness of the same idea of a natural hair movement spreading, and also in the Dominican Republic and Brazil as well, where you have a large, you know, community of black women and black women. In some African countries, we are slowly seeing an interest in natural hair and getting to the roots of their own issues with a colonial legacy. But unfortunately, in a lot of African countries, we are not seeing the embrace of the natural as we're seeing here yet. But it's coming slower. But where it's really, I think, getting exciting is in Europe and South Central America and the Caribbean, where we're seeing an embracing of and a throwing off of this idea that if my hair isn't straight, it's not acceptable. And it's really fascinating how the same rhetoric, the same language, the same excitement, you know, different language, but same concepts are happening. It's really amazing to see, and there's a lot of communication happening. Even, you know, English, thankfully, has become the language that everybody uses. In fact, we just saw a group in Italy, black women. It's called, I think, Afro something in Italy. It's a new natural hair movement in Italy of the black women in Italy. So it is spreading, and it's really exciting to see.
The last thing I want to ask you about briefly is you call the beauty parlor and the barber shop sanctified space. Can you talk about what that means?
Yes. So again, the beauty parlor and the barber shop in Black America has such amazing historical roots. Black slaves actually were often hired out to do the hair of white people, and that's where they often, you know, started their entrepreneurial enterprises, were, you know, in creating these lovely salons and barbershops. And then eventually they were able to, you know, once, you know, there was a class of blacks that had an, you know, income to spare, they, you know, started salons and barbershops for black men and black women as well. And like our churches, the salon and the barbershop was often the only place where black people knew they could speak freely without the threat of being overheard or listened to or policed by white Americans. So that became the place for women to share and talk and gossip and also oftentimes start, you know, political movements in the barbershops and beauty salons.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to jump in here. We're out of time, but the book really is fascinating. It is called Hair Story, Untangling the Roots of Black Hair in America. It's by Laurie L. Tharps and Ayanna D. Byrd. A newly revised and updated edition is available now. Laurie, it's been a real pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and enjoy your warm weather.
Thank you. We will. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help today on the phones from Katie Daniel. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.